Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Democratic National Convention starts today in Chicago. Historian Timothy Schenck, writing in yesterday's New York Times, had this to say about the Democrats' association with the Windy City. It's the city, he says, where in 1896, a 36-year-old William Jennings Bryan sent convention delegates into raptures by railing against Gilded Age plutocrats and urging Democrats to reconnect with their populist roots. It's where Franklin Roosevelt announced the coming of a New Deal in 1932, starting a political revolution that pushed the Republican Party to the verge of extinction. It's where the Roosevelt Coalition ripped itself apart in 1968, with protesters and students brawling in the streets and delegates at one another's throats. It's where Bill Clinton went in 1996 to put the ghost of the 60s to rest and build a bridge to the 21st century. And it's where this week the party of Bryan, Roosevelt, and Clinton will become the party of Kamala Harris. The fact that this is now Harris's party happened with lightning speed. It was less than a month ago, on July 21st, that President Biden decided not to run again and to endorse his vice president. In a matter of hours, she achieved the support of all the nation's Democratic governors and that of the convention's delegates. She goes into this convention with the wind at her back and appears to be gaining ground against Donald Trump in key battleground states. Democrats have gone from despair over what appeared to be a lost opportunity to defeat a man and a movement they view as an existential threat to democracy to a party infused with joy and optimism. On this, the convention's opening day, we take a closer look at the party, the candidate, the presidential race, and more. And we're joined again by Danielle Battaglia. She is congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Susan Roberts is here. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College. And Michael Kazin is history professor at Georgetown University in Washington and author of the book What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. Thank you all for being here. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Susan, let me start with you. Prior to Joe Biden announcing that he would not run again, there were these predictions of impending chaos within the Democratic Party should he make that decision. People said there would be an open fight among Democrats jockeying for position, that the delegates would be free to vote for anybody they chose to, and it would be anarchy, or at least like the old conventions used to be on the floor in Chicago. None of that happened. It didn't happen. Harris sewed it all up within 72 hours. How do you explain that?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very good thing that the calendar is working in her favor. I think having it happen so quickly, one thing that she's going to have to do is really define herself and distance herself from Joe Biden, and that she's not but Joe Biden. And I think the lead up to the election and the nomination, she doesn't have to do that herself. The infighting and the shift within the Democratic Party pretty much did that for her. What she has to do, and I could boil it down very simply, is she needs to talk about the issues and not the abstract, because voters are going to turn in to see who she is and how she's defined. Issues, not abstract.
Michael, given how swiftly and how smoothly this transition went from Biden to Harris, what does that say to you about the state of today's Democratic Party, and how does that fit in with how Democrats have generally conducted themselves behind the scenes or even in public over the years?
Well, it shows that the Democrats are a lot more united than a lot of people thought they were, partly because of Trump. Trump is a great uniter for Democrats, and also because Democrats agree on most of the issues. Biden's policies, with the exception of the war in Gaza, have been popular among almost all Democrats, moderate, liberal, very progressive ones as well. So the Democrats on policy actually are much less divided, with that one very important exception of support for Israel and the war in Gaza. That's very different from 1968, for example, where I was actually on the streets demonstrating and got arrested, opposing the convention and opposing the Democrats at that point, because then the Democrats were being split apart. As Tim Schenck's article mentions.
Well, let me ask you a question. Since you were in Chicago, I watched part of a CNN documentary on the 1968 convention over the weekend, and they said, and I don't know whether this is true or not, and I had never heard it before, that the protesters, the yippies, who were in Grant Park and all over Chicago, were there because they wanted to let the Democrats know that they wanted a change in their Vietnam policy, that they weren't really mandating it, they just wanted to be heard. Was that the case, or did you want somebody other than Hubert Humphrey, like a George McGovern or a McCarthy, to take the top spot?
Well, the demonstrators were split. Some of them were Democrats and wanted McCarthy or McGovern, who replaced Robert Kennedy after Kennedy was assassinated, to be nominated, but they didn't think that was really possible, given the hold that Johnson and his vice president had over the party at that point, Hubert Humphrey. But some of us, I must admit, like myself, just wanted to show that we were opposed to what we thought of as the war party at that time, and we wanted to do everything we could to disrupt the convention. I was 20 years old, and I didn't think much of either political party at the time. The war in Vietnam was the major issue for people in the streets, as well as many people in the convention hall.
I don't people will think when they think of the 68 Democratic Convention, unless you didn't watch it or you weren't alive, you think of the riots in the streets. The whole world is watching. You didn't realize how contentious it was on the floor of the convention. And of course, there's that famous scene that they keep replaying now of Dan Rather being essentially arrested on the floor while he's trying to report live on television. No president, Susan, has ever decided not to run for re-election after he or she has already gotten the sufficient votes of the delegates to get the nomination, which Biden did. Harris ran against Biden in 2020 in the primaries, was the first to drop out, did not campaign well. This time she's appearing before enormous, enthusiastic crowds. What's different?
Well, I think one thing I'll just add about the 68 Democratic Convention, and that is it's pretty different given social media. Everybody can get involved. Everybody hears about it. You don't have to be part of the Democratic elite just looking at this. So that's going to be a different kind of factor with 68 and 2024. But I think that looking at the fact that Teddy Roosevelt did go the second time around, but it's very different today. You say that, and my students go, "Who?" But I think it's whether or not Trump can do what the Republicans want. And that's the difference between to reset Trump and to mute Trump. I don't know if either is possible. So what you're going to see is a focus on Kamala Harris, but also that kind of "I'm going to follow where you went," that the Republicans are doing. Much of the vetting has already been done about Harris. They're trying to go in and really make accusations against Waltz.
But let me get an answer to my question, because Kamala Harris, when she ran in 2020, did not campaign well. People did not like her, which is why she was the first to drop out. And yet she was chosen to be President Biden's vice president. Is that what the difference is this time around? Because this time around, people do like her. Democrats particularly like her. So what's is has something fundamentally changed here?
Well, I may be mistaken, and I didn't prep that for today, but I believe her campaign manager was her sister, and that's not a very good thing. And right now she's bringing in all sorts of people that are really insiders. They're ready to go. They're Biden supporters, Biden campaigns, Democrats, pollsters all over the country. So I think that the clips of what she said against Joe Biden are no longer relevant.
Michael.
Yeah, I think one th thing to add to that is that 4 years make a difference in the sense that most Democrats, as I said before, do like a lot of the things that Biden did and some of the things he tried to do but couldn't do because his congressional majorities were either very small or non-existent over the last 2 years. They wanted somebody who could be refreshing, new voice, new personality. And Harris, though she's been around for 4 years, has not been all that visible. And she's younger, of course. Her ethnic background, of course, appeals to many Democrats, which is because the Democrats are very much a multiracial party, of course. So I think 4 years ago, she was running against a lot of different candidates, and people wanted reassurance, and that's why Biden got the nomination. Now they want excitement behind many of the same policies, which Biden supported.
Danielle Battaglia is with us. Let me bring you into this conversation. Danielle is a congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. We were talking about how Democrats have gone from dismissing Harris to embracing her and being highly enthusiastic, over the moon, in fact, about her in some cases. I'm curious, because you talk to people behind the scenes, is that the mood behind the scenes? Is it the mood among members of Congress who are Democrats?
It appears that way. When I was speaking with them at first, I didn't get a sense that they were really enthused by President Biden and being supportive of his campaign, but he was the nominee, and so they had to get behind him. And that's probably too extreme of what they would actually say, but that was the impression I got from talking to them. Once Harris stepped into the picture, that enthusiasm just took off with them. They very much supported her. It seemed like they started campaigning more. We just saw a lot of them go to the airport to meet her in Raleigh. I think that enthusiasm has just kind of caught among all Democrats across the country.
It also exposed something I'm not sure people thought much about, that the Democrats seem to have a deep bench. They have her choice of vice presidential candidates was almost an embarrassment of riches. And among the possible nominees would have been our governor, Roy Cooper. He appeared to be in the running. Took himself out of contention for reasons that we will never know for sure, but he did it. And then along comes Tim Walz, who took the nomination over Josh Stein, who is the governor of Pennsylvania, despite the fact that Pennsylvania has a large number of electoral votes, and he could maybe have helped her gain the support of that state without question. But now that Tim Walz is the nominee, he too has been embraced with this enthusiasm. It seems that they have found this populist guy that people just like. Did North Carolina Democrats, did Democrats in Congress anticipate this kind of thing?
I mean, I think our Democrats really wanted Governor Cooper. There was so much enthusiasm behind him. But I think once Walz got the support of Kamala Harris, they fully backed him, too. I've heard a lot of support for him. I think, you know, they're just going to keep on marching along with the Democrats. They're very supportive of both candidates right now.
Is the optimism that we're hearing reported on, do they really think they have a shot now? Have they gone from despair to this joy that people talk about with legitimate reason?
My sense is yes. If you look at the poll numbers, she is Harris is suddenly up in the polls, including in North Carolina, which is kind of a big deal for Democrats. We are a swing state in that we have a very slim majority of between the Republican and the Democrat when the Republican often wins our state, but it is often the Republican who wins. Since 1976, it's been a Republican winner, except in 2008 with President Obama. So I think they're taking the poll numbers plus the enthusiasm plus the push by Democrats in North Carolina as a good move and a good step in the right direction.
Susan, I only have about 30 seconds in the segment, but it seems that Democrats do well when they are infused with enthusiasm, because enthusiasm can be contagious among people who are not necessarily diehard Democrats. Do you think that's the case this time? I have 30 seconds.
I think the enthusiasm is going to affect the ground game, and I think the ground game is where it's going to be won. And 30 offices in Pennsylvania, 18 of them are Harris.
We have to take a break. Susan Roberts is with us. She's professor of political science at Davidson College. Michael Kazin is the professor of history at Georgetown University, author of What It Took to Win, The History of the Democratic Party. And we'll be talking about that history in a moment. And Danielle Battaglia joins us. She's the congressional correspondent for The Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Democrats on this opening day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Tonight, President Biden will set the keynote for the convention that was supposed to be his but is now his vice president's. We're talking about this with Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University, author of What It Took to Win, The History of the Democratic Party, Susan Roberts with Davidson College, and Daniel Battaglia with the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. So, in the opening, Michael, I quoted Columbia University historian Timothy Schenck giving a little thumbnail sketch of the Democrats' history and the history with the Democrats in the city of Chicago, in which he mentions William Jennings Bryan's appeal to the party's populist roots. Let's go back to the beginnings. This used to be the Democratic Republican Party, if I'm not mistaken, and it was officially christened by Martin Van Buren. So take us back to the beginning. How did this party begin and why?
Well, in some ways, it began with Thomas Jefferson, even though there were very few voters back then. It was actually, for a while, called the Republican Party, believe it or not, Thomas Jefferson. But in the 1820s, Martin Van Buren, this politician from New York State, backed Andrew Jackson for president and put together Southern slave owners, including some from North Carolina, and a lot of small business people and workers, white workers only, from the North, and put together the first mass political party in the history of the world, actually, the Democratic Party in the 1820s. It was populist with a small p in the sense that Jackson and Van Buren appealed primarily to the economic interests of small business people, and Southern planters and artisans, craftsmen in northern cities, and railed against what was then the Second Bank of the United States, financial elite, against Wall Street, against the beginnings of industrialization of industrialists in the country as well. So it was the people against the elite, and of course, Democratic Party. The root is demos, which means the people.
The Republican Party, these parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, have really switched constituencies over time. And even, I guess you could say, have switched their outlook on what the country ought to be and how the government ought to be. The Republican Party has often billed itself as the party of Lincoln, the party that emancipated enslaved people, Susan. They were also the party of big business. Democrats embraced states' rights and slavery prior to the Civil War, and was therefore the dominant party in the South following the Civil War, which began to change when Lyndon Johnson became president and signed into law, pushed for and signed into law, both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. The Republican Party, as I understand it, began a kind of realignment under Ronald Reagan when he came into office, and certainly a major realignment when Donald Trump began to campaign. How would you describe the constituencies of these two parties today, Susan?
Well, I think if you look back, there have been articles, "This is not your mother's Democratic Party," to look at the exodus of blue-collar workers, and also part the exodus of Catholic voters, and that may be attributed in part to the issue of abortion. But I think the constituency for the Republican has remained a little bit the same. I was in line once, and someone in front of me said, "I can't wait until I make enough money so I can vote Republican." And so I think that the Republicans have kept that constituency. Where I think the fluidity is the difference between college-educated and non-college-educated. And I think you can see that in the Republicans, it's a little bit iffy. And then here, the really focus for many, especially the Democrats in the last time around, Trump, the suburban women. I don't think that was really a constituency that was there in the coalition years ago. And so I think that's one difference in terms of what the groups are that help define the party. So I think it's based on money and issues and identity. Identity politics wasn't there years ago.
And how people form their allegiances and how they identify with a particular political party is very complicated. It's not one thing. It's many things, Michael. But the Republican Party has been the party of big business. And yet today they have this ultra-populist message going out that rank-and-file people who would have probably identified with the Democratic Party are now solidly behind Donald Trump and the Republican Party. What happened? Why is that the case? How did Democrats lose those people?
Well, the big reason, I think, and of course, they haven't lost all of them, we're talking about percentages, but is the decline of the labor movement in America. Labor movement's never been that strong in North Carolina, but it was very strong in the Midwest, in the West Coast, in the Northeast, and parts of the South as well, like New Orleans. And when unions were strong from late 1930s, really into the 1970s, they were a party which, they were a movement which didn't just get higher wages for people and better working conditions. Most unions are very strong supporters of Democrats. There was a real alliance between the Democratic Party and the unions. And that helped Democrats not just win those what are now swing states, places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, but also unions educated a lot of their members why they thought the Democrats were a better party for the interests of working class people. And since those unions have declined pretty drastically, especially in the private sector, only 6% of all American workers in the private sector now are members of unions, then working people, especially white working people, began to identify more with some with evangelical churches, some with watching Fox News. They learned their politics from different institutions than they had before when unions were very strong.
Especially beginning with FDR's New Deal, the party seemed focused on helping ordinary people and expanding the middle class. It is through the efforts of Democrats, correct me if I'm wrong because you're the historian here, Michael, but it's through the efforts of Democrats that Americans got Social Security, the minimum wage, unemployment compensation, the GI Bill, Medicare, Medicaid, family and medical leave. It was through the Obama-Biden administration that health insurance was finally offered at an affordable price to people through the Affordable Care Act. President Biden has worked to lower the cost of certain prescription drugs and pumped money into various parts of the country through his infrastructure projects that are now beginning to pay off, but which may have exacerbated inflation coming out of the pandemic. But it is the Republican message that seems to rank or seems to resonate with rank and file voters. What am I missing here? What are those voters missing? Is it a lack of messaging, incorrect messaging but on the part of Democrats, or just better messaging on the part of Republicans?
Well, first of all, talking mostly about white voters. Most black voters, most Hispanic voters still support Democrats, whatever their class. Hispanic voters somewhat less so. You know, I think people who are cynical about what government can do, what government has done, people who think that the government is always trying to rip you off rather than help you, historically have tended to be Republicans. That has tended to be the Republican message. I think it still very much is with Donald Trump, though he's moderated on some of those issues like Social Security. And so he speaks, Trump speaks to voters who think a big government is bad government. And Democrats have, since the New Deal, as you mentioned, been the party of government. They're the party which says, we want to do things for you. And voters who think that either Democrats have been doing things for people who aren't like them, non-white people, or just are cynical about government in general, think politicians are always corrupt, think their tax money is being stolen to help people who don't deserve it, those people are going to be more likely to vote for Republicans. And Donald Trump speaks, I think, very well, actually, to people, to that sentiment.
For a long time, Danielle, it looked as though the Democratic message would be focusing this time around on women's reproductive rights. With the passage, the overturning of Roe by the Supreme Court, that seemed to be the topic that united at least women and many men in the Democratic coalition and maybe beyond, and they thought that was going to be the issue. Then there's this perceived threat expressed by many Democrats, including the president, of the existential threat that Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans and their approach to government and democracy put in front of voters. In other words, we may not be here as a democracy if they win. That's their point of view. Harris hasn't ignored either of those issues, but she seems to be shifting her message toward an echo of Barack Obama's Hope and Change campaign. What is the central focus of her message to voters at the moment?
Well, I think right now we are still getting a feel for who she is. I mean, we know who she is, but she also is reintroducing herself to Americans and introducing herself as the presidential nominee. And so I feel like policy has kind of fallen by the wayside for the very moment. I think we're going to see that a lot at the Democratic National Convention. We have seen her come out and talk about the economy. She does have the message of hope. And I don't want to say healing, that's not the right word, but there is that hope for America overcoming what we've been through. That seems to be the messaging I'm seeing a lot, is just, I'm new, I'm younger, there's that message going on. And so I think there's a lot of just refreshing the messaging going on.
Yeah, I've read three articles criticizing her lack of policy. She's been in this race for 3 weeks.
Yep.
Donald Trump's been running since 2015. And I don't know that we know much about his policy proposals. And I don't think he's been asked. And when he asks, he never gives a straight answer to anything. So you don't know what the policy is, aside from Project 2025, which we'll talk about later on. But she seems to be embracing a lot of the policies that she allegedly helped create as vice president in the Biden-Harris administration. Those policies seem to be working. They are policies that are popular among the rank and file Democrats. Is that a wise way to go? Or does she have to come out with some big policy proposals between now and Thursday night?
I don't think we're going to see a lot of big policy proposals between now and Thursday night. I think it really will focus on reintroducing who she is to Americans. Could be totally wrong because, you know, I'm not in those meetings. But I think we really are going to see that this is who I am. This is where I came from. This is where I'm going with the country. I think the policy will follow that. But yeah, she is building on that policy that she has been part of. And she has been trying to message slightly on policy, but it's been more introducing herself.
What do congressional Democrats that you speak to behind the scenes, and what do the delegates to this convention want to hear from her on Thursday night? What must they hear from her on Thursday night?
I think, trying to figure out how to answer that, I think they need to hear who she is, what she plans on doing for America, and why she deserves the nomination.
Both Vice President Harris and her running mate, Tim Walz, are in this honeymoon phase, Susan. Going into this convention, I would assume there would be a honeymoon period following the convention, and there are only a couple of weeks left to go, like a little over 70 days before we all have to head to the polls for the final election day. How long can we expect this honeymoon to last?
Well, not to be cute about it, but I think there's the honeymoon period, and then there's the hangover period. We know who Trump is. Future always wins over past. And I think that what she needs to do is really, you know, sometimes issues are important, but for Democrats and Republicans, you want a candidate that can win and help you win down ballot. And I think the Democratic Party, it needs to be pragmatic. We talked about messaging at the beginning. The Democrats have never been really good, Frank Luntz and others have said, at messaging. You have Chuck Schumer getting on the floor and explaining. And then you've got Mitch McConnell giving, like, here's what it is. The honeymoon period, as reflected in the polls, every poll I've seen has given the caveat in kind of remembering 2022, the red wave that never materialized. So the polls indicating that honeymoon period, you know, may have that little star, the caveat, but it's going to come with that, the slim margins. I think the honeymoon period, given the lateness of the calendar, can be sustained. I could be wrong, but I think that people look back, yeah, Trump. And Harris is not Biden. Harris is new.
Michael.
Just a quick message about messaging, point about messaging. One of the problems Democrats have in terms of messaging is that they are a very broad coalition, and they've got to have a message which can speak to, let's say, Duke professors and poor Black people who live in Durham. You know, it's a broad coalition of a lot of people who are doing pretty well but have liberal views on kinds of issues, and people who are not doing very well but identify still with the Democratic Party. And they want to reach out to white working class people who they've been losing, as we were talking about. So that makes it a little difficult, you know, to have a one coherent message. Whereas Republicans have an easier time. Whatever Donald Trump wants, that's their message.
And the Democrats have been hitting on a lot of different messages, from women's reproductive rights to the existential threat of the country to recovering from the pandemic. And now, with the ascension of Tim Walz as the vice presidential candidate, a new line of attack has emerged, and that is the fact that he and other Democrats simply view Donald Trump, the Republicans, and his vice president, J.D. Vance, as weird.
People kept talking about, look, Donald Trump is going to put women's lives at risk. That's 100% true. Donald Trump is potentially going to end constitutional liberties that we have, end voting. I do believe all those things are a real possibility, but it gives him way too much power. Listen to the guy. He's talking about Hannibal Lecter and, you know, shocking sharks and just whatever crazy thing pops into his mind. And I thought we just give him way too much credit. And I think one of the things is when you just ratchet down some of the, the scariness or whatever, and just name it what it is. I got to tell you, Jake, my observation on this is, have you ever seen the guy laugh? That seems very weird to me, that that an adult can go through 6.5 years of being in the public eye. If he has laughed, it's at someone, not with someone. That is weird behavior. And I don't think you call it anything else. It is simply what we're observing.
That's Tim Walz talking to Jake Tapper on CNN. Michael, candidates from different parties have always slung mud at each other and name-called, et cetera. It seems to be ratcheting up in the Trump era. Is this any different?
No, not really. Not at all, actually. William Jennings Bryan, who you referenced before, my friend Tim Shank's piece, 1896, was called a papocrat, an anarchist, all kinds of things. Franklin Roosevelt was called a communist, as Donald Trump is calling Kamala Harris today, as well. So no, we have a two-party system, so you want to brand the other party looking as bad as possible. One thing the Democrats have to be careful, though, with this weird term, is not making it seem as if they're talking about ordinary Republicans, ordinary voters who are more Republican, that they're only talking about the candidates. Because remember, Hillary Clinton in 2016 made a mistake in a private tape talking about deplorables. We're getting close to the deplorables. And that, I think, hurt her among a lot of people who may have been independent voters, didn't like her putting down voters. So Walz has got to be careful when he talks about the weird people, that people understand that he's talking about Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, not talking about the ordinary independent voter who might be leaning towards Trump, who might be won by Democrats if they feel Democrats respect them.
Of course, the quality, if that's the right word, of this tit-for-tat back and forth, name-calling and mudslinging among candidates has degraded somewhat in the last 8 years or so for various reasons. And I want to let you hear Donald Trump's response to being called weird by Tim Walz when we come back. We're talking about Democrats and Republicans, but mostly Democrats, on this opening day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Democrats and Republicans, politics, on this opening day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We're here with Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University and the author of What It Took to Win: The History of the Democratic Party. Susan Roberts is a professor of political science at Davidson College, and Danielle Battaglia is a congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Just as the Republicans spoke derisively of Democrats at their convention just a couple of weeks ago, the same will be true of Democrats talking about Republicans. And we already just spoke about this new moniker that Tim Walz at least began calling Donald Trump, and that is, and J.D. Vance, and that is weird. Of course, Donald Trump, who has been calling people by childish names now since he entered the contest in 2016, took umbrage over Walz calling him weird.
Then he said, you know, I think J.D. Vance is weird. You know, it's a word that they use. I think he calls me that, too. No, we're not. We're very solid people. We want to have strong borders. We want to have good elections. We want to have low interest rates. We want to be able to buy a house. We want great education. We want strong borders. I think we're very, actually, I think we're the opposite of weird. They're weird. You know what they do? They work with the press on coming up with a soundbite, just a soundbite. And every station that night, all the networks, CBS and ABC, NBC, they all said, oh, they were called weird, weird. It's unbelievable. You know, it's not a word that's really used too much in politics, but it's a terrible thing that they can do this. It's just a soundbite.
He's not wrong about any of that. But the idea that he would say it's a terrible thing that they would call him weird and that they could get away with that is rather like calling the pot calling the kettle black, it seems to me. Michael, why does this childish back and forth work for him?
Well, you can say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but you can't say he's boring. He's made his mark in New York City, as a performer for the media, in effect, going out with beautiful women and getting himself photographed in various ways at various times and writing a bestseller and et cetera, et cetera, being on television. So I think it works for him because he's very good at it. You know, that's what he really is good at. I would say he's not all that good at policy. He doesn't care much about policy, but he's very good at rallying up his base and getting a lot of people to identify with him. As I said before, he's amazingly important political figure over the last 25 years, really, because he's really remade his party more than anybody else in history, yeah. Arguably, except maybe Andrew Jackson at the beginning of the Democratic Party. So that's quite an accomplishment, whether you like his politics or not.
Susan, in that clip we just played, Donald Trump outlined what the Republican Party says they are for in a way I've never heard it outlined in recent years. It was very succinct. It was very easy to follow. There were key policy stances on several very big issues. Have the Democrats responded? Have they made a statement similar to that that says, this is what we want?
I don't think they've made something that explicitly, but I think one thing I would think, that weird comment is going to, or should be translated, if I were a Democratic consultant, weird transmitted to dangerous. Yes, there's weird, but there's also dangerous. And I think that when Trump got in front of a rally and said, oh, I'm supposed to talk about the economy. Yeah, we're all intellectuals. That's an intellectual comment. I think Trump may have the topics, but I don't think he has the specifics. Kamala Harris will make a big mistake if she goes into the debate with an inventory of specific ideas, because we've seen that the American public likes succinct, and she's going to have to walk the line of not being too policy specific, and he's got to be more policy specific without, as Michael said, the bombast.
Harris has not held any press conferences since taking the leadership role in this party, the Democratic Party. Trump has held press conferences, though he doesn't really answer any questions and puts forth very few details on specific policy initiatives. And when she ultimately does answer questions by reporters, which she will have to do, and when these debates with Donald Trump take place, what issues should she, must she focus on? How must she answer questions and portray herself, both the Biden administration record that she's part of and also against Donald Trump? What does she have to say?
Well, one thing I think she has to say, she has to address the border issue and talk about it. The interview, I believe it was Lester Holt, when she says, well, I've never been to the border. That the Republicans could play over and over and over again. I think she's also going to have to address, as you mentioned, experience over inexperience. And I think you're also going to have to look at her approach to, there'll be emphasis on women, to see how she's going to perform in the debate. Just watch her aggressive questioning of Brett Kavanaugh during the hearings. She was laser sharp. And I think that's the approach she's going to have, maybe more than the issue specifics.
Michael, Susan, and you and I are old enough to remember when conventions made a difference, when they were important, when they actually accomplished something in the course of the 4 days that they met in whatever city they were meeting in. That is no longer the case. And in fact, with this convention, it's been alleged that perhaps the Democrats have ended the need for presidential conventions in perpetuity because they nominated her virtually a week ago. So there doesn't need to be a convention, but this convention will be on television this week. They have all the stars they're trotting out, all the Democratic stars they're trotting out, from Joe Biden to the Clintons to Barack Obama to Harris herself. She says that she's not much of a speech maker, but she will have to make the speech of her life on Thursday night. Are these conventions still watched? Will this be a convention that is greatly watched because of the unusual circumstances of her nomination? And if so, what does she have to say to convince Americans?
Well, it'll be watched more in clips that people see on social media, probably, for a lot of people, rather than no one's going to turn in for 3 or 4 hours a night. Well, not nobody. I will. But most Americans won't. They'll tune in for Bobby Walz's speech and Harris's speech. Well, what she has to do is difficult, I think. On the one hand, as Susan says, she has to say what she wants to do as president. She also has to make Trump seem, if not weird, at least out of the mainstream, someone who Americans don't, she would argue, want to see in the White House again, or shouldn't want to see in the White House again. But she also has to do it in as eloquent a way as possible. I mean, one of the things we forget, one of the most powerful convention speeches given, I think, in the last 25 years, was not given by the nominee, either vice presidential or presidential. It was given by Barack Obama in 2004, mm-hmm. when he kind of introduced himself. He was running for Senate at the time in Illinois, introduced himself to Americans, and that set him up to be the nominee for 2008 in many ways. So she has to, you know, sort of borrow something from Obama in the sense of speaking hopefully, speaking optimistically, and yet find a way also to make Donald Trump seem small.
Well, Susan.
In just 4 or 5 words, if democracy is at stake, if the issues are so important, and this sounds trivial, but no silly hats, no silly hats, you know, because that kind of minimizes the stake of the election. And the fact that it is going to be an election of consequence. Everyone always says, this is the most consequential election of your lifetime. Given the Supreme Court decision about presidential immunity, it is very important. So I would think just make it serious, make it inspiring, but don't go, it's not going to be, they take the low road, we take the high road. That's not going to be part of the convention as I foresee it.
Outside of the diehard Trump coalition, the MAGA Republican coalition, Danielle, there's a lot of, it seems to me, a lot of Trump fatigue out there. We had forgotten over the last 3 years about how tired we were of the constant chaos and the name calling and the grievances and the hyperbole and the outright lies that he spews every time he opens his mouth. And then there's this period in which Joe Biden has portrayed him as an existential threat to our nation and to democracy. And I don't know that he's wrong. But it seems that Harris is trying to diminish him as the boogeyman somewhat by making light of various aspects of his personality while not minimizing the threats that Democrats feel that he poses. Can this approach work for voters around the country as they watch this convention? Or do Democrats need an attack dog?
I mean, I think this always gives, conventions always give a boost to the candidate in question that's on stage. And so I think we're going to see that play out. She's going to get that boost no matter what, because she's been front and center for 4 days. I think that attacking Donald Trump as that existential threat has played well for Democrats so far in the election. I think it's yet to be seen how that's going to work out for Harris. But I think going forward, I think that is a smart approach for her if they play that off in this convention.
Michael, Vice President Harris is choosing to send a hopeful message to voters, painting a bright picture of America's future and the future of the American middle class. It's very appealing. Trump's vision has been always, since the beginning, dystopian. He sees us and he has called us a failed state, a third world country, a banana republic, one in which the economy has been destroyed, and has promised an authoritarian approach to fixing things in an administration guided by vengeance. His approach seems so remarkably un-American. Has this ever happened before in the history of the country? And if so, did that candidate win?
That's a great question. Nobody who's been elected president certainly has ever argued that basically America was a nation of carnage, as he said in his inaugural speech in 2017, and that was his major approach. We have had figures who said that, for example, in 1860, the Southern Democrat running, a guy named Breckinridge, who was vice president at the time, said that if the Republicans won, white people would be enslaved. and of course, he was running as the candidate of slave owners at the time. And also 1896, William McKinley was elected by saying that if William Jennings Bryan was elected, the Democrat, the populist Democrat that year, that anarchists would take over, the Supreme Court would be demolished, and so forth. So at times when a lot of Americans are dissatisfied one way or another with the current administration, this kind of approach can work. And of course, it worked in 2016, as you know.
Trump, Danielle, seems to be very upset that he's not running against Joe Biden because his whole strategy was predicated on running against this man who defeated him 4 years ago and who he thought, I think, because of age, he could defeat. And now he's running against a much younger person, a black woman, and doesn't know exactly, it seems to me, how to approach that. Do Democrats believe that that puts Trump on the defensive? And if so, how might this convention and their approach to it improve their chances against Trump?
I think regardless of what they believe, it appears that he definitely is on the defensive right now. He has completely changed his messaging. He seems like he is trying to get a foothold right now in how to respond to Harris as president. And so I think, yeah, going into this convention, they're going to be looking at that, looking at how to play off his insecurities as her as president and push that message forward in this convention.
We started off talking about the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. It was a very different time. The issues were very different, but there was a lot of turmoil in the country that year with the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Martin Luther King Jr. And Martin Luther King Jr. And then protesters came to Chicago en masse to ask for the Democrats to stop the war. It became a police riot outside the convention hall. It got entangled with delegates inside the convention hall. It was shocking. The whole world was watching, in fact. Did that disarray, Michael, lead to their defeat by Richard Nixon?
It didn't help. Democrats were 4 points behind in national polls when the convention began. When it ended, they were 16 points behind. So, and also most Americans identified more with the police than they did with people like me who were demonstrating. And so to the degree that Democrats were perceived as being on the side of anti-war demonstrators and also bashing anti-war demonstrators, it didn't help them in either case. I think the war was the major issue, and a lot of Americans wanted the war to end by that point. And so that, even the convention had not been disastrous, Humphrey, the Democratic nominee that year, still probably would have lost.
And there will be demonstrators at this convention. I heard yesterday that there are 20,000 people anticipated to be in Chicago rallying against American support for Israel in the wars that are going over there in that Mideast conflict. And they were heard chanting already, in part, we won't vote for genocide at a rally that Vice President Harris recently held. Her response was sharp, and it got cheers from supporters.
You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
At subsequent rallies, she called for a ceasefire when speaking to protesters. Is her position changing? Has she handled hecklers, which all politicians seem to get now, has she handled them properly in a way that does not diminish her in the eyes of the majority of voters, Susan?
Well, I think that this is going to, the hecklers and the demonstrators are going to force her to have a more articulate policy on the Israeli-Palestinian war. And I think handling hecklers in a way that just, you know, when she needs to not turn off certain voters. And are you going to just not vote? And as she said, not voting is a vote for Donald Trump. And at the margins, if you have enough people and they're young people that the Democrats need in their coalition, I think that's an issue. The protesters here are against some of the things that she needs to articulate.
The Republicans said they conducted, and many pundits said they conducted, a perfect convention, and it probably was in the eyes of Republicans. Will Democrats be able to pull the same thing off? Very quickly, Susan, I have 10 seconds.
I think they can, but it has to be choreographed, and it has to be on message, no surprises.
Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Michael Kazin from Georgetown University, Daniel Battaglia from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.